International Capital Market Insights from ICMA.
Good day, everybody. My name is Arthur Carabia. I'm a director at ICMA. I'm in charge of running the secretariat of our Asset Management and Investor Council. And ICMA is organizing a series of podcasts to discuss with members how they are navigating this unprecedented global pandemic situation. And I have the pleasure to be joined today by Geert Dijkstra, a senior managing director at APG Asset Management, and Axel van Doorn, managing director, legal, tax, and regulatory at APG Asset Management. Geert, Axel, many thanks for joining me today. And I'd like to kick off maybe with you, Geert, and I think we could go back to the basic, and you could tell us a bit about the specificities of APG Asset Management before we deep dive into more technical topics.
Yes, Arthur, thank you for the introduction. And thank you, Igmar, for the opportunity to share some of our experiences and thoughts with you. APG Asset Management, that's the pretty large Dutch pension money asset manager. We have a handful of Dutch pension funds as our clients. We have currently around 530 billion euros assets under management. And we tend to say that we are a global leading long-term and responsible investor. Global, obviously, because we have a global coverage of the assets in management, working from offices in the Netherlands, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing. Leading because, and I'd like to elaborate later on that, because I think in responsible and sustainable investing, we are a leading party. And long-term, obviously, when you're a pension fund asset manager, by nature, you have a long-term horizon. For us, that is 15, 20, or 30 years. And I think it's important to acknowledge that around 4.5 million Dutch citizens are the participants in the pension funds we manage the assets for. One thing I like to mention is that we typically ourselves, but certainly also driven by our clients, focusing on responsible investing in all our portfolios. So that's a start.
Thank you, Geert, for giving us a bit of an overview of what APG Asset Management is doing. And I think you're, of course, a different kind of asset manager. You described it very well. And I guess I'd be curious to know, how did you navigate the market turmoil in the first half of 2020, given your pension focus? What was your immediate response and priorities in the first half of 2020?
Yeah, that's a very relevant question. How did we react in the first weeks of the corona crisis? Along two lines, if you allow me. The first one is business continuity, and the second one, our investment portfolio. When I look at business continuity, typically we send mid-March all staff home, working from home, and I think our ICT department did an incredible good job to facilitate that. I think nearly all 900 people working in the Netherlands, US, and in Asia were able to continue their work by Teams, Zoom, etc. So that was very interesting to see that it, in fact, make us, a digital performing organization. And so the processes and the procedures were all in really relatively short term as normal again. Then the investment portfolio. I think it's important to acknowledge that having pension funds as your client, in their decision making, the asset liability coverage ratio is essential. So obviously, with decreasing assets, the coverage ratios, it became very, very much under tension. Happily enough, there were some wise decisions made, so there was no need for us to do any forced sales, or we were not in a position to, were forced to buy. Flexibility of the investment plan agreement under the prudent person rule was essential for that. The second thing is that we were able to pretty fast put again a focus on the long term, so we could pursue the long term investment strategies. And of course, coverage ratios are mostly under pressure and still are, but certainly also because of the low interest rate effects on the liabilities. Then I think it might be interesting to see that we followed up with scenario thinking. Basically, we have been building scenarios along three lines of uncertainties as the basis for those scenarios. The first uncertainty is the progress in controlling the spread of the coronavirus. The second uncertainty is the intensity and the duration of the reduction of economic activities. And the third uncertainty we work with in our scenarios is an answer on the question, does the corona episode change the economic order forever? For instance, in value change. Having said that, we build three scenarios. And if I put it simplified, you might say we have a new normal scenario. And in this scenario, the global economy slowly recovers from the COVID-19 crisis with subdued inflation, interest rates lower for longer. The second scenario is a slowdown. And in this scenario, the assumptions are that a second wave of infections and a return to lockdowns will come up, with growth and inflation falling again before climbing back. And the third and last scenario is a mean reversion scenario. And in this scenario, it's all about mean reversion, in which economic growth and inflation will revert to a historic pre-crisis mean. So those are the most important things when I look back at a COVID-19 start. Currently, again, we still work with the scenario thinking. If you look at the assets under management, there was a all-time low in the third week of March, but gradually it picked up again. So in early July, you already saw that the size of the assets under management was pretty near where we started in the beginning of this year. And well, again, you see now there's a tremendous fear in the markets for the second wave. So you see that there is a pressure on the at least the listed assets. So that's to summarize our response to the COVID crisis.
Gert, you mentioned the uncertainty or the stress in the market at the moment, COVID cases rising, valuation being pretty high on all sorts of markets. What are your views at APG on where the market currently stands?
When you look at the listed equities, you can easily see that the analysis are in terms of, is there still a sound relation between the markets and the underlying real economy? And we do think there is a tension between the short-term reflection of the illicit assets and real economy. And that might be well caused, one, because of the fear that's in the market for the second wave, but also because there are a lot of new entrances in the illicit markets, especially from the consumer side. Although, as well, as we are very much aware, from the hedge fund side. And that makes that there's a lot of money going around that gives a level of valuation, which is, we think, for the long term, not a sound reflection of the underlying real economy. So there will be a correction in due time. Then when I just step back to the three scenarios I mentioned earlier, you can see that, and again, we are a long-term investor. We look at the forecast for instance, the five-year expected returns. You see that there is a scenario, the mid-scenario, where you see that the risk-return trade-off has improved and pushed for lower levels by expensive fixed income and risky assets, except for commodities. When you look at the near normal scenario, you see that in the coming 5 years, our expectation is that it will gradually come back to the levels we know from 2019. Then I'll move towards the alternative investments, so the illiquid assets. That's more challenging because we don't have for all assets in that area an actual valuation. If you look at the real estate, private equity, and infrastructure portfolios, I think we only have nearly an idea of what a true valuation will be in the coming years. So it's more challenging to give a straightforward answer on your question, how the valuations will and the returns will be in the coming 5 years. But to summarize, from an absolute return perspective, the five-year expected returns are, you might say, muted by historical standards. So if I would have to look into the near future, you might say that potential outcomes of the crisis might be a handful. Potential outcomes for me are, for us, are that in the United States, for instance, the United States could be less dominant in the corona crisis, partly because the division between the states and the federal government, and of course also the upheaval towards presidential elections. And there is also a strong market and individual orientation, which makes it plausible that it's the US as a economic bloc might be less dominant as an outcome. China, as the next, although possibly coming out of this crisis stronger, cannot yet take over the leading role in our view. The country is not yet sufficiently trusted in its role in the world stage, as evidenced by the criticism on the corona crisis itself. And then Europe is, you are very well aware of, I guess, a populist divided, and will have to get its act together for a European Union renaissance scenario to become one of the 3 to 5 regions which humanitarian and economic processes will take place primarily. So that is a regional perspective on the outcomes. If you'd like me to elaborate a bit on the crisis and technology trends, we might think that Europe has a weaker technology sector than the US and China. Some sectors like pharmacy and biotech continues to grow in the further quest to boost the human body and immune system, as well as healthy living and eating themes. When you look at another sector like mass entertainment, that may take a hit over digital individual entertainment, and perhaps something of the appreciation for luxury and branding may disappear in our view. And the next, another experience of the already out of control tourism is obviously that all that business travel, is that really necessary? Question mark. And then one other important perspective for us is that climate goals and sustainable quality of life are even more prominent in business strategies as we see them.
Thank you, Gert, for navigating the investment outlook and having such a sharing this granular analysis with us. I think you described a very complex world that you have to navigate through. There's, at least in the short term, a bit of certainties that monetary easing will continue in the short term, and we know it's a double-edged sword for pensioners and pension funds and IPG asset management ultimately, because it exacerbates challenges for you to generate revenues and income for pensioners. How do you, in a low interest environment, how do you provide pensioners the income they need, protect their capital when they get close to the retirement age? And Axel, do you have any views on this challenge as a whole and what the ECB strategy review outcome will be?
Well, thank you for that question. I think it's a very important theme, not only for pension funds, but also for banks and insurance companies. And I think the strategy review by the ECB does not come too early. Among other things, the continuing low interest rates have created doubt and analysis about the sustainability of the Dutch pension system. Until now, that has been a defined benefit system, and as such, it had certain guarantees for benefits to pensioners. So fixed income instruments always have formed the basis of this system. And now recently, during the COVID crisis even, but long before that also, but there's kind of been a breakthrough during this crisis, plans have been adopted to reform the Dutch pension system to be less dependent on interest rates and to shift part of the investment risk to pensioners. It will become more of a defined contribution system in the end of the day. So the low interest rate has already got a big influence on the pensions and the pension system in the Netherlands. Although early analysis shows that the way APG Asset Management will invest for its clients will not be very different in the end of the day. So it will not change very much. The results for pensioners can be very strong, because their pensions will in the future fluctuate more with the markets. So it will be different, and that has a lot to do with the continuous low interest rates that has been in the markets for, I think, about 10 years right now.
Arthur, if you allow me just to describe briefly the Dutch pension system, which is a three-pillar system. The three-pillar system in the Netherlands is consisting of a first pillar, which is a state pension. So everybody who lives and has been working in the Netherlands and becomes currently is in the age is 67, gets a monthly pension payout by the state. So that's the first pillar, and we have nothing to do with that. Then the second pillar, in the Netherlands, most of the employees are participating in a pension fund, which is organized by the sector, so the industry, or sometimes by the company. And we have in the Netherlands still around 220, 230 pension funds. Again, mostly organized by industry sector, some by company. And this is mandatory for the participants. And this is the market segment APG Asset Management is active in. So five of our pension fund clients are in this, what we call second pillar. And then we have the third pillar. The third pillar is individual pensions, which mostly are serviced by insurance companies. The second pillar pensions are what you might call, by, if you look at their characteristics, they are a collective defined contribution pension. Although we have a history of collective defined benefits, in my view, it is typically now what we have a defined contribution system. And that implies that there is not yet in the current system a individualized pension pot or what anything would look like that. So basically, everybody who becomes 67 again gets a pension from their pension fund, a monthly amount of money paid out, and the rest of the money is still invested. So also after retiring, the pension money returns because it's still invested. So you see that there is in the current system no individual pension pot. Having said that, there has been a long-standing debate in the Netherlands on the current Dutch pension system, which by the way is ranked mostly every year again in the top three of world's best pension funds. Having said that, we had more than a decade, a fierce debate on that, because there were tensions between the generations, there were discussions about transparency, etc., etc., and it added up to a new pension system, which will be implemented, I say that by heart, in 2026, and there you for the first time see in the Netherlands, in the second pillar, a more individual pension scheme. And there you might find a life cycle part built into it, but that's not yet the case. So the only life cycle, as you described it, you'll find in pillar three, when you have an individual pension where you can decide upon. And I know this differs our system from the Scandinavian pension system, the Australian and New Zealand pension systems, where you have a individual choice where your assets are invested in. And that is non-existent in the Netherlands currently.
Very clear, Gert. Thanks for clarifying this. We were discussing about short-term trend, central banks monetary easing remaining for a while. And there is also mega trends that we know are not going to go away, and probably they will accelerate with COVID, namely sustainability and digitization. And I was wondering if, Gert, you could say a few words about what APG Asset Management is doing in that space.
I think it's, for us, we're pretty proud of that. We have quite a history in responsible and sustainable investing. I think the first time you see that part of investment decision was made in terms of sustainability and responsible investing was around 2005, 2006. not a few years later, we had a department working on that. And I think it's for us, but certainly driven by our clients, the large pension fund clients. Typically, we have a what's called a square perspective on investment decision making. And the square, the four angles are return, risk, cost, and ESG. And all four are embedded fully in the investment decision making processes we have here internally in APG Asset Management. So yes, we have a history. Yes, it's important. And to illustrate that, it's I think interesting to see that our clients give us very clear and quantitative investment targets, responsible investment targets. So, for instance, our largest client gave us as a target to reduce the carbon footprint in the listed equity portfolio with 25%. Another one is that we had a target to build up an investment portfolio in sustainable development goals, the SDGs, of 58 billion euros. We were requested to build an investment portfolio in renewable energy of 5 billion euros. So this illustrates that our clients give us very clear and quantitative targets in the responsible investment targets. Moving to the current situation, we have been developing ourselves from a exclusion policy, which was traditionally saying no to things like tobacco, if your clients don't want that, saying no to certain types of weapons, cluster bombs, for instance, saying no to certain countries like North Korea. And we moved away towards a what's called an inclusion and ESG integration policy, which is, if you allow me to summarize that, making a selection by looking into the universe of companies and divide them in leaders, laggards, and exclusion. So the first step in analyzing is to structure our investment universe in sustainable and responsible companies. You might say the most easy part is the exclusion list, which is still there, because you're not going to invest in them. They are not going to be part of the portfolio. More interesting, obviously, for us are the leaders. We first look at their status in terms of sustainability and responsibility. And if we deem them to be leaders, we do a risk return analysis. And when they are attractive, they're typically in a portfolio, possibly as leaders. If the risk return analysis gives a unattractive view, then obviously we are not going to invest in them. Then the mid category, which is for us interesting to look at, are the laggards. So in terms of ESG, in terms of sustainability and responsibility, they are laggards. And in the next step, we look at a risk return analysis and opportunities for engagement. And if there is an attractive risk and return profile going along with those laggards, and there's opportunities, there are opportunities for engagement, they might be in the portfolio as promises. Obviously, is the risk return profile is unattractive, we're not going to invest in them, but they're also not excluded. That's an important development in the past few years. Looking forward, you might say that we already had, as illustrated, a pretty challenging set of targets in the period 2016-2020, and our clients, especially our largest client, ABP, came up with a new sustainable and responsible investing policy for 2020-2025. So we have a new set of challenging targets on responsible investing, including aspects as engagement and voting, the inclusion policy I just described. Of course, climate change is core in that policy, as well as sustainable development goals and investments, and the collaboration with other like-minded peers and setting standards. I hope that gives a bit of a brief view on what we are currently doing in the area of sustainable and responsible investing.
Thank you, Gerrit. This is very clear and fascinating to see how it has evolved. I imagine that you still, I understand you move from exclusion to inclusion, but I imagine there's still some sectors that you're trying to avoid, or there is no such move anymore.
There still is. There still are some sectors our clients request from us not to invest in. And it differs per client, it differs per pension fund, but obviously we follow, for instance, they all follow the United Nations PRI framework, which includes the exclusion of certain types of weapons, investing in certain types of weapons. But one of our clients also decided not to invest in tobacco any longer. So yes, there is still exclusion, but it is not a dominant part of our sustainable and responsible investing policy, because that is done in an inclusion policy way.
Yeah, you mentioned when we spoke before the podcast that you're also using digitization or technological tools to enhance your sustainable investment. Do you want to say a few words about what you're doing in that space?
Sure. You see that where we apply sustainable and responsible investing, we also see that there's a lack of relevant data. So what we did in that area is that a team of artificial intelligence specialists built a platform, a SDI, asset owner partnering platform. We did it together with a handful of like-minded asset owners to build a source of public, based on public data, and the source of information for decision making in sustainable and responsible investing. So what we see there is that we have entrance to structured and unstructured information, make reports on companies on their, for instance, their carbon footprint, to fuel our decision making on those companies. That is I think a perfect illustration on how we use modern technology, together with others, by the way, to apply in our investment decision processes. Another good example is that we are also digitalization applying on our quant equities and fixed income strategies increasingly. So there we see that, driven by the ambition to reduce costs, driven by the ambition to move faster, we apply technology in that areas as well. I think it's important to mention that we are not a very large or wealthy asset manager, and that implies that we have limited budgets to do that, to apply technology, new technology in our processes and procedures. So we often try to find what I tend to call like-minded peers, asset owners, which are on the same page with regard to investing and responsible and sustainable investing, to join forces in investing in technology. I think the first example I mentioned, the SDI, the Sustainable Investment Development Investment Goals, is an initiative from next to APG Asset Management, the second largest Dutch pension asset manager, PGGM, together with Australian Super, the largest Australian pension fund, and British Columbia, a large North American asset manager. So it's an excellent example of joint forces trying to set global standards, as well as applying modern technology in investment decision-making processes.
Yeah, Gerrit, so I think we share your mission, and we try, you know, as ICMA, trying to push the commission, who's also doing it anyways, but they are about to review the so-called non-financial reporting directive. So hopefully you'll have more raw data in the very near future to input into your technology, and for you to be able to make even smarter decision on the sustainability front. But fascinating to hear, internal development and industry stakeholders cooperating to make this agenda move forward for the benefit of investor and the society. So thanks for giving us an insight on what you're doing on that front, and overall explaining how you've been managing this really peculiar time. I think we've covered a lot of ground, and I'd like to thank you both for taking the time to speak to me today, and hopefully people have enjoyed our podcast, and in the near future we can touch base again and have another conversation together. Thank you both.
Thank you very much, Arthur, for giving the opportunity to be in this podcast.
Yes, thanks, Arthur.
Thank you for listening to this ICMA podcast. For more podcasts and more information about capital markets, check out our website, icmagroup.org.